Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on Monday, August 13th, 2012. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com every Monday live from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time and from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are available 24-7 on DrSaputo.com and PRN.FM.
Today you're going to hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 20 to the hour. And we've got a fantastic show for you today that's going to include, can telling the truth or telling lies affect your health?
And does a modest weight loss have health benefits?
And what can you feed your kids if you want to increase their IQ? I know a few that can use that.
And the effect of antipsychotic drugs on kids and teens.
And how about the smell of this fragrant essential oil to prevent falls? A lot of elderly people are going to like that one.
Well, anybody would.
Yeah.
And if you'd like to join in our conversation and have questions about our topics or your health, give us a call on Mondays from 10 to 11 Pacific Time or 12 to 1 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Oh, can telling the truth affect our health?
Isn't that the weirdest thing?
Liar, liar, pants on fire, hanging on a telephone wire.
Yeah, I've heard that one. How'd you feel when somebody called you that?
I didn't like it.
I think it changed my hormonal system.
And also, have you ever heard anyone say, I've never told a lie, and you thought that's the biggest lie he or she ever told?
For sure. Who hasn't told a lie? Or at least a little white one now and then, huh?
Well, and then you visualize their nose getting longer and longer, just like Pinocchio.
There it is.
Well, my parents used to tell my brothers to stick out their tongues to see if they were black.
Oh, gosh.
And you know, when I think about that now, that was a lie right there.
Well, we so lie
was,
a lot.
So was Pinocchio and hanging on a telephone wire. But, you know, now a new study shows that telling the truth can improve mental and physical health. And according to this study, the average American lies 11 times per week.
Oh, what an understatement that is.
Really?
I think
for yourself.
Well, let's see. How many people are authentic? By that, I mean how many people are honest about the way they feel, even to themselves. You know, we cover up a lot of things and worry about what people will think of us. And then we tell them what we think they want to hear. That's a little white lie. Now, that has to happen dozens of times every day for an awful lot of people.
And so does exaggerating. That counts as a lie.
Absolutely. So I think they define little white lies as big white lies, and then, of course, the big lies, too.
Well, also, have you ever known anybody that accused you of something that wasn't true?
Oh, that's the worst.
And how that feels.
Well, that's right. Well, a study was done at the University of Notre Dame. And what they found, they had 110 people who were in this sample, most of which were college students, actually, but also about 35% were up to age 71. And they studied these people for 10 weeks, and basically, they just told half of the participants to stop telling major and minor lies for the 10 weeks. And the other half served as a control group, but they knew what kind of study they were in, but they didn't get any formal training about it.
I thought it included white lies, too.
It does.
Oh, okay.
I thought you said
major lies.
Both. And so they did that, and the way they did it is they had people come in once a week, and they took these health and relationship tests that they had, and they also put them on a lie detector, on a polygraph test. So presumably they got the right answers from that. And what they found was that the link between lying less, okay, and lying more was a huge difference in their health and in their mental health and how they felt. So it's interesting that the people who were having these, were telling a lot of lies, and they were in the group that was instructed not to lie, they told about four fewer, they had four fewer mental health complaints every week, and they had less anxiety and sadness about what they were doing. The people in the other group were a tiny bit better because they knew what they were in, but they weren't the ones that were getting the major benefit from it.
And what about the physical symptoms?
A lot of things like fewer colds and less problems with headaches and probably back pain and other kinds of symptoms like that.
Well, you know, another thing, it's stressful to tell a lie.
Exactly.
You know, they, that's what they tell the people that go to court. They say, just tell the truth, because if you lie, then you can trip yourself up, and you'd have to end up telling a lie to cover that lie, and
exactly.
It goes on like that, and then who's going to believe you if you tell a lie? You know, that's like crying wolf.
Well, how can you keep track of what you did if
it wasn't
the
truth? And I know people that exaggerate. I mean, when they exaggerate, then you always have to kind of change it in your mind and know that they've exaggerated.
Well, who doesn't exaggerate sometimes?
Well, I know you do.
Oh, yeah, right. I've never heard you exaggerate.
I don't.
No, of course not.
Never.
That's right. Well, who tells a major lie? I mean, why would somebody tell a lie?
Well, some people, I know people that have told lies, and pretty soon they've told them so many times that they believe their own lies.
Mm-hmm.
And try to talk somebody out of something that they believe, even if it's not true.
Well, that's right. But what kind of people tell lies? I mean, why would somebody do that? You're really looking at people that don't have a whole lot of self-confidence, because if the truth gets out, they don't think they can handle it.
They want people to like them, I guess.
Well, that, and they also want to make sure that they get what they think they're entitled to. So they may lie for a lot of different reasons.
Maybe they're showing off. Maybe they want
to
sound like they're rich and dress fancy when they're in the poorhouse.
Well,
know?
A lot of people try to do that.
And some people do it the other way.
So,
they lie and make it sound like they're poor and they're loaded.
Uh-huh. Well, I think that it depends on how authentic you are and how you will present yourself honestly and openly so that you can really be the real you. You know, most of us come from families that are dysfunctional. I'd say everybody has some dysfunctionality in their family history. And when you're like that, you try to cover things up because you can't handle them. Because at the time that all the problems that you developed happened, you were a kid. You didn't have the tools and you didn't have a way of solving a lot of those problems. So what we have to learn over time is that we're really okay and that it's okay to be authentic. In fact, if we don't, we'll never really know who we are, and neither will the people around us, and so the relationships will be limited.
Well, I know they found in this study that telling the truth improves relationships, and I think that it's really true, because I would like people, I like to know where I am with people, and I grew up in a family where there was a lot of guessing. You know, like, I wonder if they really mean this, or I wonder what they really mean, and all this kind of thing, all this, you know.
That's testing for boundaries, that's right.
Yeah,
and a lot of times boundaries aren't clear.
But that's why I'm drawn to people that just say how it is, even though sometimes that can be tough, you know, but at least you know where you are.
Well, look what happens to you when you're under stress of having to tell a lie and you don't feel good about it. What happens to your stress hormones? Cortisol goes up, adrenaline goes up, noradrenaline goes up, and probably dozens of other hormones and neurotransmitters change.
Yeah, but what about, too, when people do things that they really shouldn't do, and then they either lie to cover it up, or they don't talk about it because, and they don't admit it or bring it up or anything because they don't want to get themselves in trouble. So
that's exactly what.
Stay out of trouble. Do what you're supposed to do,
if
and
you
then
can.
You don't have to lie.
Well, don't come from a dysfunctional family. See, that's the problem.
Good luck,
and
well,
so how can you deal with that? That takes experience. So these stress hormones that change make a big difference in your health. I mean, when you don't get enough sleep or you're under any kind of stress and it changes your metabolism, you're at risk for things like heart attacks and strokes and osteoporosis and hypertension and diabetes and cancer. All these things come up and bite you in the long haul. We've got lots of studies that show that. So there's no question that this is something that's a huge issue that we just don't have a good handle on until we come to a place where we're developed and authentic.
Well, maybe this will help people to be aware of it more and to catch themselves when they're telling a white lie.
Well,
you know?
I think that's right. Well, that's the whole point of this study, is to say, look, there's some objective evidence here that shows that if you can change your pattern of telling lies, and they found that after 5 weeks, the people who were in the treatment group actually thought they were being more truthful about things and felt better about themselves because they could present themselves authentically. I mean, what's it like to go through life and having to pretend to be different than you are? That's a little white lie for sure.
Well, that's stressful.
Very stressful. And that's why it's not surprising that we see the physical changes in people's health. And if the study was long enough, see, it's only 10 weeks. What if it was 10 years or 30 years? Then you'd start seeing massive changes in physical health. You'd also see massive changes, as I see so often in my office, when people come to me because they've got emotional issues that are keeping them from being authentic as well.
You know what else is interesting with this is that people want to be truthful and they want to have this great relationship, and yet they want to keep peace. So they don't want to say everything what they think in the relationship, or then they might end up fighting or arguing, and then that can cause more stress. And so it's like, I guess just knowing when it's best to bring things up and when it's not. And is it lying to not bring up every little thing that bothers you?
Well,
you know?
It is, but it's about protecting yourself, and it's defining the boundaries of the depth of your relationship. And of your relationship, particularly to yourself.
And it's good to be polite, too. I mean, just
well,
because...
Well, being polite doesn't mean telling a white lie, necessarily. It can be. But it really is a sign of weakness.
Well, one of the things they did in the study was that they said if somebody asks you a question that you don't want to answer, to change, kind of like change the subject
ask
and ask them
a question yeah.
to get them off of it.
Well, but, there are a lot of tricks about that. But what you're really looking at here is assessing the state of maturity, the state of how you're in touch with yourself, the state of your authenticness as you're running your life. And we would all do better if we lied less, but we have to go through the process of realizing that it's okay to be who we are.
And be true to yourself.
Yeah, because if you can't be true to yourself, that's the biggest lie of all. And that's what this whole business of authenticity is all about.
Well, you know, if somebody's lied or somebody's done something that they shouldn't do, and if they admit it to you and say they're sorry, that kind of stops it. I mean,
makes it a lot better.
Yeah, it really does help.
And a lot of the things that we learn as kids that are dysfunctional because our role models, our parents and other role models in our life, our teachers early in life, they play a big role in teaching us who we are, where our boundaries are, and what's okay. And a lot of what happens in our young life is that we unfortunately don't get the opportunity to express ourselves openly and honestly and have it be okay. Look at all the physical, emotional, and sexual abuse that's out there. Look at the number of people that are latchkey kids because they're home by themselves and they're in front of a TV a lot of the time, and they're learning about boundaries that have to do with sex and violence that are not appropriate for a kid.
Yeah, and many times they're told to not tell that.
Right. Well, so these are things that that lead to the problem of telling lies because we can't be authentic, of trying to please people by being, a lot of the time, even passive-aggressive.
I know with children, it would bother me more. I would be more angry if they lied to me about something than whatever it was that they did.
Well, your kids don't lie either. I mean, that's...
Well, no, I trained them not to, but when they were little, sometimes, you know, kids just do that.
Well, they want what they want.
One of my sons would, like, Mom, how did you know? How do you always know if I don't tell the truth?
Yeah, right. Well,
I still have never told him.
So is he telling you the truth now?
Certain expressions.
Well, we're learning to define our boundaries. That's what this lying business is about. Where are the boundaries between your being at peace with yourself? What can you do that's okay? When do you worry about what people will think about you? When is it border on legal or not legal? All these things are very interesting aspects of defining who we are and how we operate in society. There's far too much of this going on in our culture. I mean, look at our political nature in Congress today. We've got 525 liars that are out there, right?
Yeah.
Because they've got ulterior motives. They've got conflicts of interest.
And politicians.
And they've got things that they want, okay, that the only way they can get it is if they're corrupt. And they're not going to be open about that, so they're in stark denial of things. Even people who are really good people, as I think most people who go into politics to begin with are, they're out there doing what they think is the right thing, and they get to Washington, D.C., where they start to learn the ropes and what and how it works, and the next thing you know is there are conflicts of interest all over the place. They're being bribed by people with a lot of money. The person who's in Congress thinks about how they're going to get reelected, and they're telling more than a little white lies, but they try to make them look like that. Then they come back, okay, after they've been there and they're in front of the people of their district, and they're saying, oh, I'm only honest, and I will only do the best, and I promise you I'll do better than I even did.
And
how many lies can you tell?
And putting other people down to build themselves up.
Well, that's right. And that's what you're seeing in the political elections that are going on now. I mean, look at the race for presidency. It's a joke. You can hardly know when you're getting a straight answer or when you're getting some kind of BS that you can't trust. So what we learn about how to behave ourselves in life has a lot to do with the situation we're in. And our boundaries, unfortunately, are defined by a society that's not well. I mean, we've lost our democracy. We no longer live in a democracy. We live in a corrupt system that is all about money, economics, and power. And all these lies that are put out there to substantiate and make it okay are just really bunk. So we need to wake up to this. And this tiny little study that's talking about the effects on our health and on our levels of stress is just a tip of the iceberg. We need to do a lot to come back into a place where we're being much more functional, much more direct, much more clear and honest so that we can know who's telling us the truth, who's not, who's a friend, who's not, who's well adapted and got sensible boundaries and who doesn't. All those things are absolutely vital. And when we don't live that way, things are like they are today, folks. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. We're opening up the lines now at 888-874-4888. So if you have a question about your health or you want to enter the conversation that we're having, give us a call. So now it's time for Vicki's first 20 tip on the Yaya Sisters.
A group of the old gals got together, the Yaya Sisters, and they were having some conversation, and one of them says, you know, if you love something, set it free. If it comes back, it'll always be yours, and if it doesn't come back, it was never yours to begin with. But if it just sits in your living room, messes up your stuff, eats your food, uses your telephone, takes your money, and doesn't appear to realize that you had set it free, either you married it or you gave birth to it.
Oh, jeez.
The nice part about living in a small town, when you don't know what you're doing, somebody else always does.
That's unfortunately the truth.
And the best way to forget all your troubles, wear tight shoes.
Distraction works, huh?
You know, it's amazing. You hang something in your closet for a while, and it shrinks a couple of sizes.
Not fair.
Okay, now they're going to be sharing a diet. This is the Yaya Sister diet, and you may have heard of this diet before, but it's worth it to hear it again to refresh your memory, because this is what happens. So for breakfast, one grapefruit, one slice of whole wheat toast, and one cup of skim milk.
How admirable. Sounds good.
Lunch, one small portion of lean steamed spinach. Chicken.
Okay.
Chicken, steamed chicken.
Right.
One cup of spinach, one cup of herbal tea, and treat yourself with one Hershey's Kiss.
All right, fair enough.
Okay, by afternoon tea, with the rest of the Hershey Kisses in the bag, a tub of Häagen-Dazs ice cream and chocolate chips.
Wait a minute.
Well, she's getting hungry. Then
dinner,
four glasses of wine, red or white, two loaves of garlic bread, one family-sized Supreme pizza, and three Snickers bars.
It's been a rough day, huh?
Late night snack, one whole Sara Lee cheesecake. You can actually just eat it from the freezer. Remember, stress spelled backwards is desserts.
That's cool.
Well, if you want to handle every situation, I can't even talk. Handle every stressful situation like a dog, pee on it and walk away.
Oh, jeez, Vicki.
Oh, my gosh, did I say that?
No, the Yaya Sister said that. That's great. All right.
Well, you know, that's what happens when people diet. You know, if they really do starve themselves and feel like they're depriving themselves too much, then they're going to get too hungry later and pig out.
Well, you know, they kind of reflect that we have to get a certain amount of satisfaction, and we do the best that we can to try and be good, okay, to eat less and to exercise and to get enough sleep and all the things that we should do and have all those healthy boundaries. But when we don't and we're just trying to restrict ourselves, it doesn't work because we'll move from one bad habit to the next. And then we'll be, the next thing you know is you'll be eating broken cookies and you'll be eating little pieces of food because they don't have calories, right?
Yeah, they don't count.
They don't count.
Well, this kind of leads us right into this study that came up about modest weight loss and how that can actually have lasting health benefits.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to live a longer and better quality of life, you want to keep your weight in check. And the number one health challenge facing our country today is obesity. And research shows that if you're overweight and you can lose just 10% of your body weight, that it can make a significant difference in your health over a 10-year period, even if you regain it later in that decade. So what are some of the things that it does and that it's helpful for you to do to keep your weight in check?
Well, there are a lot of things to do. I mean, you have to understand that weight is a very, very complicated issue. We're looking at things like hormones and sexual abuse and sleep and environmental toxins and drugs like the antipsychotic drugs, which we'll get into later, that make you gain weight. A lot of psychological issues and addictions to sugar, fat, and salt, and even quitting smoking. And all these things, what do? They put you at risk for all these illnesses that are out there. Diabetes, hypertension, heart attack, strokes, osteoarthritis, and even poor self-image.
Well, the main thing here is that it can improve your quality of life and it can improve your mobility. You know, a lot of people that are overweight, they get back problems, it's hard for them to walk, it's too heavy for their knees, you know, when their stomach's sticking out and all that kind of thing. Another thing, overweight tends to add to a problem of sleep apnea.
Uh-huh.
But what were some of the suggestions that they talked about to help people to keep their weight in check?
Well, they looked at 3,000 people, okay, in this study that they did. And what they did is they helped them to lose weight with artificial approaches that I don't particularly think are great because they don't last. But the point they had here is that if you could keep 20 pounds off for 5 to 10 years, that the benefits that you would get...
Well, that's if you had weighed 200 pounds.
Well, 20 pounds, it was 10% of their weight. So if you were 150 pounds, it would be 15. If you're 120 pounds, it would be 12. And if you could keep that weight off, okay, for 5 to 10 years, that the impact that you would have on diabetes and other kinds of illnesses was quite a bit different. In fact, type 2 diabetes was reduced by 58%, even if people put this weight back over the 10-year period. So what we have here is that modest weight loss can have a big effect, okay, on our health for long term. So it's worth doing.
The other thing to be aware of is how sugar is so addictive, and it does affect the brain and the craving. So the more sugar you eat, the more you crave, and we know that sugar is not a healthy thing. You know, there's natural sugar that's in fruits and things like that, but adding refined sugar is not a good thing. And so one of the things they were suggesting was maybe setting up some laws with limits and to curtail the advertising to kids on things that are high in the bad fats and then sugar.
Right, sugar, and eat more fiber. I mean, all these things we can learn about and we can take some kind of action in. And if there's a program, like in schools or in other places as we go through life, it would make a big difference in educating us at least about what the problems are with being overweight, looking into why we have it, and then, of course, having a good healthcare practitioner of some discipline who can look into whether or not you've got hormonal problems or if it's a sleep problem or, I mean, even environmental toxins cause inflammation in the body. And when we're in an inflamed state, what do you think happens? We wind up with insulin resistance and we wind up with leptin resistance, which are two major hormones that play a tremendous role whether or not we will have a bigger appetite than we did before.
So getting really healthy food inside your home is one thing that's helpful, and of course exercise. But the thing about the food is that many times when you go out, you can't always, you know...
It's harder to control, but you
control
can
control that. But
if you're
can control. You can control what's in your house, and if you don't have it in the house, then you can't have it to snack on. So,
all right,
especially for kids.
You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuna here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. If you have a question about yourself, and we have a call from Cassandra from Atlanta. Hi, Cassandra. How are you doing?
Hello.
Hi, Cassandra.
Oh, Oh, hi, it's me. Okay, hi.
How you
I'm
doing?
I'm in a sprint store. I am excellent. I just got a release today from a surgeon from three fractures, a pubic fracture and two tailbone fractures. I've called y'all before along the way.
Wow.
You said no on anti-inflammatories. I did my research on that, and they are terrible. So
that's
I've
right.
cut them completely out. I've cut out aspirin. I've had a stroke. So I found a couple of enzymatic things. I don't know if you've heard of Arthur Andrews Medical, but they put out a product called Cerita. It's the Serapitase. And I took one bottle of that. It's supposed to really help you in inflammation and stuff. And I wondered what your thinking was about enzymatic therapy, because I'm so excited about it.
Well, it's one good way to do it, Cassandra, and it may help with pain quite a bit. We use that a lot in people who have injuries where there's where there's more coagulation, particularly in the area that was injured, and that may reduce that will reduce inflammation, and that will make pain a little bit better too, a little less pain. But there is another approach that I like to use in my patients, where we use infrared light therapy. And it's called photonic stimulation. And if you would like to learn more about that, I'd urge you to go to my website at drsaputo.com, put in infrared light therapy. And there are about 50 different audios and videos there, but I'd do the first one that comes up. And it'll give you an overview of how it works and how safe it is and how powerful it is. It does a whole lot of things that would help immensely.
So, oh, that sounds so lovely. Infrared.
Infrared light therapy. Put that in the search box, you get the answer, and go from there. Another thing that may help over the areas that hurt is DMSO. That's dimethyl sulfoxide. That's why we call it DMSO. It's too hard to pronounce.
Yes.
And you can get that at a lot of at some pharmacies, or you can get it online. So it's another thing that you could try. So and then of course doing some kind of physical therapy would be really good.
Yes, I am in physical therapy,
and, then,
and I'm having him, I'm hoping he will do this for me, and that's just massage my back.
Yeah, a good way to go. Nice gentle massage and get your alignment right. Oh, okay, well, I hope that helps you, Cassandra. Thanks for calling.
It does. Thank you, and thank you for all your wonderful information on your website.
Thanks a lot.
Take care.
Have a great day. Oh, thank you. Thank you. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. And we'll be back after a short station break from PRN.FM. So stay tuned. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number, if you have a question about your health, is 888-874-4888.
Well, here's a no-brainer. Children's diets can affect their brains.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, an Australian study shows that a child's eating habits can affect their brain development and their IQ. So, in other words, eating healthy versus eating junk food. And they looked at 7,000 kids, little kids, between the ages of 6 months and 2 years, and they measured their IQ at 8 years of age. So, you want to tell us what they found?
Yeah, well, no big surprise. The kids who had had the healthy diet, see, they had four different diets. One was home prepared, okay, so that was real food, whole foods. The other was prepared baby foods. Then there were those that were breastfed, and then there were those that had whatever they wanted, which is mostly junk food. And those people that were eating the best foods that were breastfed had, on the average, two more IQ points at age eight, and those with junk food diet had up to less. So there's a four-point differential between the worst diet and the best diet. And a lot of our kids could use at least four more IQ points for sure.
Well, the study mostly reinforces the importance of providing kids with healthy foods at a crucial formative time in their lives.
Right. I mean, when their brains are developing, they've got to have the raw materials to make product, which is brain tissue and other tissues in the body. And if you don't have all the raw materials, how are you going to do it? Think of it as each cell as a microscopic industrial plant, and it has to have raw materials to make product. So if you're short some raw materials, what's going to happen? You're going to wind up with being unable to make certain things. Maybe you can't make enough in the way of the healthy fats that are in your brain, the essential fatty acids that are absolutely essential for brain to be developed normally. The fact is, 60% of the brain is made out of what? fat. So if you're building a car, for example, and you're short a steering wheel or a spark plug or a tire, you don't have the raw materials to make them, the car's never going to work. The human brain is the same way. And we know from the USDA studies called the Haynes studies, there were several of them done, at least three to my knowledge, on tens of thousands of people. What they found was is that we had massive deficiencies in certain kinds of vitamins and minerals and nutrients that without which we can't be fully healthy. So things like essential fatty acids, 95% of the population is deficient in that. And you look at things like...
Well, that's eating the important healthy oils.
That's right. So things that are in like flaxseed oil or in fish oil or in evening primrose oil, things that are found in vegetables, all those really healthy omega-6 essential fatty acids that we need to be not processed in some way that wrecks them. So diet becomes absolutely vital for not just a child, but for everybody. But we're in that section of our life where we're developing our brain and the rest of our body at a very rapid pace. You haven't got the raw materials, you can't make the product. It's just that simple.
Yeah, so we really have to consider this longer-term impact of the food that we feed our kids. Parents have a really important role during this time.
I'll say.
As we've said before, it is possible to avoid junk food at least before they start school, because then they're influenced by other kids. But at least in your home and before they start school, get them off to a good start.
Well, once they get to school, they're going to be doing what? Eating school food. They're going to have the vending machines, which a lot of schools have, although that's changing a bit. Lunchtime, they're going to be full of carbs. They're going to be using trans fats and lots of foods that don't have fiber.
Well, and then there's school parties and all the birthday parties, and they bring cupcakes and cookies and treats.
So you've got the high fructose corn syrup, and you've got the unhealthy oils, and you've got low amounts of fiber. I mean, that's a recipe for a disaster. We should be eating whole foods that are organic, not processed, not refined. If it looks like a tomato or a carrot, eat it. If it's in a package, if it's got an ingredients list that's a mile long, better think twice, because that's not a whole food, and usually it's got stuff in it that, you can't even recognize a lot of the time some of the things that are in there because they got big, long names.
And they try to trick you, like the labels will say that it has all these healthy things on it, and you start reading the ingredients list, and it's like most of it's bad stuff, you know, like trans fats or lots of sugar and additives and so forth.
That's right. Well, it's the same thing when a mother is pregnant. We need to take in all those foods that we need, the folic acid, the iron, the essential fatty acids, the vitamins, minerals, and nutrients that we need. And if they're not there, I mean, how's the baby going to develop normally?
Well, it's a good idea if you think you want to get pregnant to get started before that. Well, it's good to have a healthy lifestyle anyway, but especially if you think you're going to have a baby.
Oh, I would start a year before making sure that the diet was excellent, and then I'd probably take a prenatal vitamin on top of it because I think that would be good to cover the bases.
And also to seriously consider breastfeeding, because that's the healthiest balance and the best food for your baby.
No doubt about it. All right, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuti here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888 if you have a question about your health. And it's now time for Vicki's final 2020 tip on the generous husband.
Well, there are several men that are in the locker room of a golf clubhouse, and a cellular phone on a bench rings, and a man engages the hands-free speaker function, and he begins to talk, and everyone else in the room stops to listen.
Right.
Hello? Oh, hi, honey, it's me. Are you at the club? Yes. Well, I'm at the shops now, and I found this beautiful leather coat. It's only $2,000. Is it okay if I buy it? Oh, sure. Go ahead if you like it that much. Oh, boy, I also stopped by the Lexus dealership, and I saw the new models. I saw one that I really liked. How much? $90,000. Okay, but for that price, I want it with all the options. Oh, great. Oh, and one more thing. I was just talking to Janie, and I found out that the house that I wanted last year, it's back on the market. They're asking $980,000 for it. Well, then go ahead and make an offer of $900,000. They'll probably take it. And if not, we can go the extra $80,000 if it's what you really want. Okay, I'll see you later. I love you so much.
Jeez.
Bye. I love you, too. Well, the man hangs up, and the other men in the locker room are staring at him in complete astonishment, mouths wide open. And he turns and asks, anyone know whose phone this is?
Oh, geez. Talk about a troublemaking. That's not a white lie. That's a big one. I think there may be trouble in that household later that evening.
Well, laughter's the best medicine. That guy's not going to misplace his phone again.
No, the lines are open. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. The number is 888-874-4888.
So antipsychotic drug use is growing in U.S. kids and teens. What's going on? I mean, are we creating a drug culture with 1 in 3 kids' visits to psychiatrists resulting in a prescription for antipsychotics?
Well, this is a disaster. I mean, we have become so much the result of the pharmaceutical industry's power. It controls medical education. It controls the bulk of research. Two-thirds of the research that's done in this country is paid for by Big Pharma, and only one-third by the National Institutes of Health. And this affects medical schools in terms of the research that they do because they get funded for it. It also affects what the students are going to be taught because it's going to be what Big Pharma wants because the medical centers aren't going to bite the hand that feeds them. And now we've got, in psychiatry, a group of doctors that practice psychiatry that are more psychopharmacologists than they are listening to people and doing psychotherapy.
Well, don't you think part of it's because the health insurance companies prefer that they write the prescriptions because it's cheaper for them than paying for the doctor visits?
It's slightly less expensive, but and that is a small part of the reason, but the big reason is the propaganda and the political power. It's the muscle that influences how doctors are taught. The doctors are absolutely taught in psychiatry to be psychopharmacologists. And now when you look at using antipsychotic drugs, things like Risperidone and Geodon and Zyprexa, Seroquel,
Abilify,
all these drugs that are very, very powerful, and then giving them to these kids who have ADD or other health conditions for which the FDA has not approved it because it's called off-label usage 90% of the time. I mean, and this is published in the Archives of General Psychiatry. You got a major problem here.
Well, antipsychotics are for people that have psychosis, that are psychotic, that have schizophrenia or bipolar or even autism irritability symptoms, but not for ADHD.
No.
It's not approved for that. That's, like you just said, that's off-label use. And I think one of the things that promotes the use of these drugs is some of these TV ads. I don't know why we even allow ads for prescription drugs like that.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's the pharmaceutical industry's brilliance. You've got to give them tremendous credit for their creativity and for making ads like that available and trying to convince people that this is what they should do. But you almost have to be stupid to listen to those ads and then think, this is what I need to do, and then go to your doctor. Because when you listen to the lineup of side effects that they often, well, they always present at the end, it's like, who in the world would want to do that just so that I don't urinate as often or some other problem that you have that may be a minor thing?
Let's talk about some of the side effects, because we know that they're linked to weight gain. And it can quadruple the incidence of diabetes.
Those are two big things. And some of the weight gain that you see here is 30, 40, or 50 pounds. It's not like it's some small little thing. So we're looking at a problem here that has to do with creating the metabolic syndrome, which is the precursor of type 2 diabetes, in an awful lot of people. And when you talk about putting 1 in 3 patients, kids, children, okay, who are seeing a psychiatrist on an antipsychotic drug, something's frigging wrong. That's just too much.
But you know what else? They're prescribing other drugs besides the antipsychotic.
So this is the tip of the iceberg even for that.
But for antipsychotics, like these drugs we just mentioned, the Abilify and the Risperidone and so forth, Zyprexa, it also can affect your temperature. It can disrupt the temperature in the brain.
Well, the temperature of the whole body, and what you wind up with is people having heat strokes because your body can't cool itself like it normally does in the summertime. But this is mostly older people who have that, but even for older people, this is way overused. I mean, look at how often they're used in our hospitals on the elderly who get confused and they can't be managed right, or in nursing homes. I mean, this is commonly used, even though it states right on the box, in a black box warning on all these drugs, that they should not be used in people who are elderly, because the all-cause mortality goes up.
Also not in women that are pregnant.
Well, I mean, who should really be on them is a few schizophrenics, a few people who have manic depressive psychosis, and an occasional person who has some other kind of thing that can't be managed any other way. I'm not opposed to off-label usage, but I am when it's 90%, which is what it is with this particular case. So this is just outrageous and a disaster. So what are the kinds of things that happen to people besides those that we just mentioned? What about tardive dyskinesia?
What is that?
Good question. When you lose control of your body parts and they're moving around and you're contorted in your face and your arms are waving in ways that you can't control them, and it looks
great,
like
then they give you more medicine to stop that.
Well, true. I mean, you look like you have cerebral palsy, and some of this is irreversible. And you want to take that risk? I mean, maybe if you had to. And it raises your cholesterol on triglycerides. It also causes something called hyperprolactinemia, which means your prolactin levels, it's a hormone level, goes up. And men will develop breasts, and they will develop milk, and they will also a lot of the time develop impotence or prolonged erections. You can get seizures if you're on anti-seizure medication. It causes headaches and tremors and dizziness, all kinds of things that are just a disaster. And somehow, that's thought to be okay. I mean, we should be looking at what is happening to psychiatry.
People pretty much ignore the side effects. They don't want to know what they are. And the doctors, I think, don't like to bring it up much because they want the patient to take it.
Well, I mean, doctors are good people that go into the field of medicine because they want to help people. Then, unfortunately, they get there into medical school and they start learning what is being handed down through Big Pharma into the teaching protocols in the courses that we take. And so we learn to become experts in using the drugs that are made by the pharmaceutical industry. If you think of a symptom, you'll think of a drug. It's almost like a game. You think of pain in a joint, you start thinking of nonsteroidals. You think of a problem with congestive heart failure, you start thinking of certain drugs are for that, or for hypertension, or impotence, or ADD, or for schizophrenia. It's like, let's match them. Here's the disease. What are the drugs? It's not we're looking for underlying causes, which of course we always should be doing, because the underlying causes are what are causing the problem. And a lot of the time, that's a combination of your genes, what you eat, and your toxic exposures.
You know, too, you were also talking about kids that have ADD and how it's often prescribed for off-label use that way.
Yes.
And many times it seems like children are overdiagnosed with this condition.
Way overdiagnosed.
ADHD. And many times what it's diagnosed for is because they're difficult to control in the classroom or at home or whatever.
Yeah, they're impulsive
and it makes
kids
it easier,
who have outbursts.
Yeah, and it makes it easier to take care of these kids. And maybe it would be a better idea if they had some sort of parent and teacher management training for kids like this.
You think maybe? I think absolutely. I mean, to me, it's criminal that we're putting 5% of the population on drugs that control ADD.
Well, I mean, some kids are a little hyper, you know.
Well, for good reason. It's because of the dysfunctional nature of their family life and school life, and nobody's really listening or caring about what's happening to them. And you want the quick fix, or go to the doctor, let the doctor fix it, and the doctor is learning from Big Pharma, and the next thing you know is you're taking a bunch of drugs that keep the kid in a stupor, almost stupor state. all too often. And it's not like that happens all the time, and it's not like these drugs shouldn't be used in some situations. They absolutely should. But what it takes is somebody who has something called common sense, who knows how to do the art of medicine rather than just what's told to us to be the science of medicine. And it really isn't anyway, because the research is corrupt. Too many conflicts of interest.
And here we talk and complain all the time about how obesity is an epidemic and more kids are having this problem, and nobody's thinking about how some of these drugs can add to that problem of the obesity.
Oh, for sure. You talk about using antipsychotic drugs in a kid, you're talking about making him fat, and you're talking about putting him at risk for heart attacks and strokes because they're going to develop, a lot of them, diabetes, type 2 diabetes. No, it's a disaster. So I always ask myself the question, what the hell has happened to psychiatry? I mean, we used to be learning about Freud and Erickson and Jung and people who were going into the psychodynamics of what happens during childhood, and then listening to kids and trying to support them through the PTSD that almost all of them have, because that's how kids are raised these days. There are too many conflicts going on. There's too little listening. There's not enough understanding. And it doesn't get much better in school because we're trying to make rocket scientists out of everybody instead of people who are good people who are trying to live in community and support one another. And that's exactly what we need to go back to. So until we do that, and psychiatry's on the path that it is, it's not going to get better. We're just going to be covering up symptoms, not treating the underlying cause. We need to evolve to a higher level of consciousness. I keep saying that in every show we do. You have to evolve to a higher level of consciousness so you move from being narcissistic and self-serving and involved with conflicts of interest and trying to gain power and money to somebody who wants to be a member of the community, part of a village, to support the benefits of the whole place, to give and share and love instead of this stupid approach we take where we don't just have wars at international, we have wars here at home.
So one of the alternatives to giving drugs for people that have problems and that are stressed and so forth are essential oils.
Isn't that interesting?
And, you know,
essential oils.
Yeah, they found this study about preventing falls in the elderly and how that would extend and improve their quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of drugs to prevent the agitation and in turn reducing their falls, the essential oil of lavender has been found to prevent falls, among other things. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about how serious falls, especially in the elderly, can affect morbidity, and mortality,
for sure,
and poor functioning, and the inability to participate in social activities, and just helping people's quality of life.
Look, if you're older, and you're in a nursing home, and you're not getting much sunlight, and you don't have much vitamin D, you're not exercising a lot, and you're maybe even confined to bed a lot of the time, you're going to be weak, your balance is going to be poor, you're going to have thin bones that can lead to osteoporosis, and you may have a lot of pain because of low vitamin D levels as well. These people need to be helped in some way so that they have better balance, they have more strength, they need to be out in the sun, they need to be supplemented with vitamin D, and it's much safer than using the antipsychotic drugs, which they tend to use, even though they have a black box warning.
And the psychotropic medicine.
Yeah, or too much in the way of anti-anxiety drugs or antidepressants. When you go to a nursing home, which I frankly can't stand anymore, most people are on an average, I'd say, of 10 or 15 drugs. And you put 10 or 15 drugs, you can pick the ones you want in anybody and think it's not going to screw them up. Think again, because all those side effects which occur in every single drug are cumulative.
Because it's the same thing with the elderly as it is with the little kids. They want them to behave, so they give them sedatives.
Well, they can't control them, and sometimes it's a major problem.
Well, yeah, especially when they start wandering around and pacing the halls.
Or they get violent and they start hitting.
Yeah, and this is where they found that lavender oil comes in,
mm-hmm,
and it can be really helpful. They did the studies on this.
Right, and so what do they find? That it improves balance and agitation. It works as a great relaxant. There were fewer falls in the small study that was done that dipped
like
you off.
It's like a sedative. It helps them sleep.
Sure.
It even helps them with their pain.
Sure, and with depression. So it's something that makes a lot of sense. when we take things that are natural, found in nature, not everything is good for us. I mean, you don't want to take some things that'll make you sick. I mean, you certainly don't want to take things that are toxic that are found in nature. But a lot of things that are found in nature are things that help us. And there is a wide range of herbs and different kinds of plant substances that are found in nature that have a use in helping us to recover from the symptoms that we have or the illnesses that we have. And lavender oil is one of those beautiful things. It's simple. In this particular study, they just put a lavender patch on people so they could smell it, or they put a placebo patch on them so that, I mean, there was no lavender there, and then followed them for a year and found out there were a few less falls. That's kind of like the tip of the iceberg. And it's not the first drug that we know of that's like that. We know that lemon balm was studied probably about 10 years ago and came out in an article, and we made a report on it. So if you go to drsabuto.com, you'll probably find a few articles that talk about things like this. And when they used lemon balm, all they did with an agitated patient was put a little bit at nighttime on their upper lip so they would smell the lemon balm, the agitation went down, and the insomnia went away in a lot of them. These are simple things to do. You know, these poor people that are in nursing homes, they need support. They need to be listened to. They need to be cared for. And I'm not saying that's always easy. There's nothing like...
Well, they're human beings. That's the thing you need to realize. These are human beings. They're not to be just treated like a number.
Yeah, well, when they lose it and they become combative and they're difficult to manage, then what do you do?
And you that's give them a bath and lavender.
Well, that's a darn good idea. Why not do something like that? Because it makes the most sense. So,
well, and to be with them and to touch them and maybe to listen, to have some music in the background that's relaxing, you know, like some of Stephen Halperin's background music that's so relaxing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's right. You know, we have a caller who apparently is an educator in this field. His name is Greg. Are you on the line, Greg? Greg?
Yeah, I am.
Oh, good. We just got about a minute or so, but I'd like to hear what you have to say.
Well, I just happened upon your station just via the Internet, and I'd just like to say that my wife and I are school teachers,
uh-huh.
And what you're talking about with drugs with children,
yeah.
I just want to say, I swear I thought we were living in the Twilight Zone,
yeah.
Not sometimes, but all the time. And I feel like we're abusing children with the drugs that we give them,
yeah.
With the food that we feed them in schools, and
mm-hmm.
That parents need to take a more proactive role in actually teaching their children behavior methods, you know, and really taking ownership and not just put drugs in them, because, you know, it's really something that's a problem out there in our schools, and it's tough to manage these children when they're just really just on drugs most
you know,
of the time.
Boy, amen.
Amen, and Greg, thanks for calling. We're out of
great
time.
For you.
I'm glad you called.
Saying that.
You have a great day. It sounds like you're doing good work. All right, we're at the close of the show, and I'd like to remind you that we'll be back live to talk about what's new in the news and health and take your health questions every Monday afternoon on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com from 1 to 2 Eastern Time and 10 to 11 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7 on DrSaputo.com as well as PRN.FM.
And if you've enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on DrSaputo.com. And check out our Fast Track videos. And remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
See you next week. Have a great week.